I just want to say before Anna starts speaking, it's been a real blessing to have her. She doesn't like accolades and things like that, so deal with it. We have been really blessed to have Anna with us and to do these Rocio Christi nights. I'm newer to the church as a pastor here, so I've only got to be in person for a few of them, but as soon as I heard them, I went to the YouTube page and listened to the rest of them because they were so fascinating and wonderful and just incredible. So you guys are in for a great evening, but I just wanted to say welcome, and I'll hand things over to Anna.
Thanks. Okay. Did I turn it on? Okay, I did turn it on. Hi. Nice to see you. I have a polite disclaimer this evening, so we're going to start with a little bit of a disclaimer just to give you kind of a heads up. We're going to be covering some painful social issues, including abortion. I'm well aware of how rife with emotion that topic is, and so I want to be transparent up front that my handling of that and the rest of the subject matter tonight is not to make anyone in-house or watching online who has experienced abortion in any of its facets to feel attacked. But I realize sometimes this cannot be helped, even if I wish it otherwise. So I'm going to ask that you please consider joining me in what I know you can handle well, whether you agree with me or not. And it's what's called the Oxford manner, meaning that you're capable of entertaining and honestly considering a series of thoughts as an exercise of pure reason. This way we can come to a knowledge of the truth together, knowing that this is what was intended and not that you were singled out as a target. For this reason, I have not shied away from images of genocide in this presentation, including one image depicting the foot of an aborted child for reference. In my initial setup for this presentation, that picture was not included, but after realizing that Google has made it near impossible to access real photos of aborted fetuses, even with safe search off, it is my duty as your friendly neighborhood apologist to do the right thing, to honor the dead that are purposely being hidden from public view and the free access of information in what is supposed to be the penultimate nation of personal freedom in the world. I will not surprise you, and there is a warning in case you wish to look down both visually as well as, I'll give one verbally. I'll alert you when the images of genocide have passed as well, so you can look back up. Please know that I'm a dedicated Christian. Jesus has healed me of a great many things. He can certainly heal what you've experienced and will do so if you'll let him, life after an abortion included. All right, we have made it to our final study in deconstruction. It is over after tonight. So if you've been bored this whole time, it's over. This is a phenomenon within our immediate community and the church abroad, where individuals who have grown up in and around the culture of Christianity suddenly realize, sometimes even after attending and pursuing things like Bible college and formal ministry preparations, that they have not authentically interacted with the substance of the Christian religion. And suddenly, what they thought they knew about faith and belief gets turned on its head, oftentimes in very painful ways. And so they leave what they thought they believed behind and adopt whatever alternative to Christianity they can find to fill that void. Secular humanist social justice, generic spirituality, resentful atheism, pitiless indifference, you name it, so long as it isn't some form of institutionalized religion, sometimes never to return. If you've been with us through our previous sessions, then you'll note that we spent the first session defining the problem, addressing the philosophical foundations of common objections, and then moving through material that I know you will face soon if you haven't already, while blazing head-on through weird passages of scripture that are often hang-ups for Sunday school-type deconstructionists. And we did that just in case there were those in the audience who in the future might be faced with those same objections. Session 2 built on the foundations of session 1, isolating the number one objection that deconstructed Christians raised to we apologists, hell, where we once again made a precise investigation of the misunderstandings surrounding eternal separation while simultaneously facing head-on more random, weird Bible verses that just don't seem to get focused on regularly enough for those verses to not get used as ammunition in a deconstruction context and in more emotively based series of objections. And now finally, we build one more time. Only this time, I want us to do the work of not just answering the objections that are normally raised in this overall deconstruction discussion, but to do what every apologist worth their salt is called to do, and what we train you to do here at Rosher Christie, to anticipate future objections to the best of our ability, stepping into the shoes of someone going through this painful process, steel-manning their position accurately. And you'll recall from one of our previous sessions that steel-manning is the opposite of straw-manning, and it is a quintessential aspect in the anatomy of persuasion, sacrificing time and effort to understand precisely what is occurring, and to build on their belief, or on their behalf, excuse me, future frameworks, such that when they see them, they will be reminded that their loved ones did work in the past on their behalf, in what they would need moving forward when they reach that point, that we love them and will show them that at every step of the way, even if each step takes them further away from Christ. Because as painful as this is for many of us, each person must decide for themselves whether or not they belong to Yahweh. We cannot believe for them. So tonight we focus primarily on removing the planks in our own eyes so that we can accurately assess splinters in our loved ones. Apologetics is spiritual surgery, after all. It's not rational to try to go into these discussions blind. And so I want those of us who are not deconstructing to do some reflection tonight first, to make certain we are preparing our attitudes, thoughts, and behaviors for correctness. Again, that is the normal protocol historically for Christians to pursue holiness and the discipline of our whole selves. Remember this slide from our sessions before the pandemic? Our deconstructing loved ones do not need dismissal. They do not need repeated tearful or grief-filled angry appeals to just come back to church. Those appeals are completely understandable, but we need to take those straight to the Lord in prayer first, unless, of course, you're prompted otherwise. I know that this is an issue of discernment, and I'm just giving overall guidance here. They need those of us who know what we know about Christ to be Christ, sacrificing our time and energy on their behalf to give a defense for the hope that is in us. And so I want to begin with showing you what I think is actually going on here. How precisely do we jump into the shoes of our deconstructing loved ones? And how does Anna do the work of demonstrating what that looks like in real time to those who are already deconstructed and attending these nights? I'm going to do my best to not be a glaring hypocrite calling everyone around me to do work that I'm not willing to do myself. It's one thing for me to give analogies like I did on night one this semester with the panic attack suggestion, and in night two where I did cognitive behavioral therapy frameworks. It's quite another to take hours to sit down and dedicated personal reflection and to be thoughtful about what going through deconstruction might look and feel like for my loved ones, and then forcing myself to get precise about their very real and very genuine experiences. Because those are two markedly different things, and I want to be clear about that. If we claim to be the church and we claim to care about those in our midst going through this, then we must do both. We need to help them treat their symptoms while also investigating the source of the symptoms. Treating symptoms of an ailment without investigating what caused the symptoms is, after all, a form of malpractice. And since we are representatives of the great physician, malpractice is never favorable. So we do both. Nights one and two are treating symptoms, and now we're going to talk about isolating the source. So here we go. It's going to sound like I'm rambling for a few minutes, but I promise I'm not. So just walk with me in your mind for a minute. I'm not introducing you to anything uniquely mine. I'm just going to show you how I walk through my knowledge base to try and do what I have been encouraging you all to do so that you can see what I mean. I'd like to suggest that what I think may be happening in the head of a deconstructing Christian is a sort of sublimation. In psychology, sublimation is a mature type of defense mechanism in which the person believes that an impulse they're having is unwanted. And for our purposes, because they believe the culture around them won't accept the behavior. For example, a common sublimation is what happens when you go through a bad breakup. Immature defense mechanisms are to recoil into alcoholism or self-destructive behavior. A mature defense mechanism would be to funnel all of those negative emotions into doing something the surrounding culture would see as positive. An example of this would be when someone responds to a bad breakup by funneling their negative emotion into a home renovation project, for example. There's nothing particularly bad about venting your emotions in that way from a cultural perspective, and you aren't abusing yourself with harmful addictive substances, so it's seen as a better form of dealing with those unwanted impulses. Sublimation is why you hear some parents teach their children to release frustration by screaming into their pillow. as opposed to biting their sibling, for example. One is an immature vent, and the other is a more mature or more preferable vent of those emotions. You get the idea. What sublimation attempts to do is to relieve painful emotions as quickly as humanly possible and in a way that the surrounding culture will not judge as harmful. There are no value judgments here, except in the case of physical harm. So anything will do as far as a vent is concerned, so long as it's culturally subjective, mature type vent. And in the case of our current culture, a mature type vent is being sought in the form of low resolution thinking and representation of the world. Our culture makes a practice of low-resolution thinking. Our entire social dynamic functions primarily in this framework. Low-resolution thinking is when you take an ideology or study or name any complicated topic, really, and you boil it too far down. You oversimplify your thoughts on that subject to such a degree that you lose out on the significance, and it's actually detrimental to your ability to see the world accurately. And in some cases, even in the formation of completely false conclusions, when you return to engage that topic matter again. Low-resolution thinking is not intrinsically bad, it's just low-resolution. And oftentimes, low-resolution representations of the world are really misleading. This is opposed to high-resolution thinking and representation of the world. High-resolution thinking is when we entertain complexity of thought with precision. This takes an immense amount of cognitive energy and time, and unless you're really practiced at it, it's frankly very uncomfortable. But high-resolution thinking is needed in order to accurately handle complex concepts. And just like low-resolution thinking, it's not intrinsically bad. It's just that it's not always necessary. And so why would a human being ever opt for this on a regular basis when low-resolution thinking generally works? I'll use an example from one of my favorite psych lectures that is a personal example to me to illustrate. You've heard me reference cars and other community nights, so you'll already be familiar. Okay, consider your car, for instance. Your daily driver, nothing special. No one goes through the process of thinking through every nuanced mechanism in our vehicles every time we drive them. We consider our cars on a low resolution level. For us, our car is the thing that gets us from home to work or the grocery store, or whatever. We don't really think about it, we just get in, turn the key, and go, for the most part. But the reality is that our cars are extremely complex, and they always have been, whether we think about it actively or not. We just don't engage the complexity in our thoughts because low-resolution consideration is all that is needed to accomplish the task at hand, and this is, after all, the fundamental definition of something working. You don't have to think about it anymore because it works and you can move on. Very rational, but also low resolution. But what happens when your car breaks down? Immediately, we're flooded with the reality of complexity, and for me, and I bet for you, it happens at a level that produces real and immediate stress and anxiety. Now my car is not just that thing that gets me to my destination. Now the car is full of detailed needs and parts that have massive implications. How will I get to work? What will it cost to fix this? Can I trust the person who is diagnosing the problem, or am I being cheated or duped somehow? Will my husband take this happenstance as a learning moment for his mechanically anxious spouse to study YouTube videos on how to replace a starter because he insists I need to know how to do that in the zombie apocalypse? Will the subsequent fight that occurs because I'm already late for my meeting and I would prefer to be eaten by zombies than learn how to replace a starter affect my marriage? See? Complexity. The car always had these elements. I just never engaged them on a cognitive level because it is really unpleasant psychologically and I wasn't being forced to by anyone or anything yet. And why would I? How could a human being possibly function in high-resolution thinking all the time on every subject? We can't. We'd be basket cases. But this low-resolution, high-resolution dynamic has implications for us on a way deeper level than cars. You have behavioral norms. We all have them. Things we've operated in our entire lives but have never thought about on a complex level. And these personal norms are the mechanisms that drive our individual judgments and personal philosophies, even our worldview itself. We have low-resolution behaviors we can't even completely isolate in our minds. How do we know this? Well, you can identify these norms on a low-resolution level because you'll get upset when someone else violates one of your norms. And we see this happen on a regular basis in interpersonal relationships. Have you ever experienced that person who for some reason just gets on your nerves, but you can't quite put your finger on why that is? Also, why is your favored form of loading the dishwasher intrinsically better than your spouse's way of doing it? Why is it when someone out of the blue offers you your choice of coffee cup, you immediately discover that you do have a preference, but it's not clearly evident to you why that preference exists since 2 seconds ago, you didn't even know those coffee cups existed at all? Why do you walk into the sanctuary of a church and immediately have a preference on where to sit? Why are you sitting in the position you're sitting in right now as opposed to the person sitting next to you? It's just comfortable, I guess, you think to yourself as you realize that the you that is you inside of your head has never precisely broken down why the you that is you inside of your head is like that at all. And that would be because you haven't needed to. Low-resolution thinking is preferable because it's less invasive and it's more comfortable at first gloss, and it normally works, and our culture adores it and practices it at most levels of analysis in our everyday lives. But the you that is you inside of your head is actually insanely complex. You have habits and intuitions that are a consequence of your learning and your social environment. And you actually have no idea where your philosophical and therefore behavioral norms come from exactly. There are psychological mechanisms that we're still discovering. It's actually impossible for you to detect precisely how these things developed in your psyche. And it's all of this phenomena and all of its complexity which exceeds our normal comprehension. Because, again, why would we bother paying attention to any of those things if we think our life is working? Just like in our car analogy, so long as your life is working, the complexity moves to the periphery of your mind. So, for our intents and purposes for the discussion this evening, our initial representation of ourselves, philosophies, norms, and preferences is low resolution. But the reality of what is unfolding in our lives is what is actually true. It's high resolution, even though we don't see it. Which means that in the context of getting reality really right, we must force ourselves to move high-resolution assessment out of the periphery and into the front of our faces in order to even begin discussing fundamentals, like assumptions about how the world works, like assumptions about how truth is determined, like assumptions about how the Bible was put together, or who wins when two experts in their respective fields disagree with one another. And it is this move from low resolution to high resolution that is called the unconscious structure of belief, meaning that there is an entire system of belief that drives your decision-making and worldview that you have no conscious knowledge of yet. It's just there under the surface waiting to be discovered. As an apologist, I cannot read minds, but because I know about unconscious structures, I know that there is a need to discover them if we care about actually being really real and truly accurate about the world around us, especially when our worldviews are crumbling and being dismantled, like in deconstruction. I know that the only way for a person to identify a fundamental axiom of their unconscious belief versus a peripheral one is that when I accidentally touch on a fundamental, it'll upset you more than a peripheral one will upset you. It's what happens when you are talking to me about something difficult, some random, heady subject, and you begin inexplicably crying. And some of you will even begin apologizing and saying to me, "I don't know what's wrong with me." There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you at all. All that has happened is that we have just witnessed an indicator that there is a tear or a crevice in your axiomatic structure. We've discovered a part of your unconscious that needs to be unpacked. So that when I went investigating something on the surface, my metaphorical finger dropped into a hole in your conscious where I touched a fundamental that you didn't know you had. Think of it as like a psychological exposed nerve in a hole in your mind that we unexpectedly fell into. And even more precisely, that hole in your axiomatic unconscious structure is where the reality of your complexity and high resolution, self, bubbles up into a conversation that was previously low resolution and is now accidentally high resolution and therefore overwhelming. Your brain is acknowledging that you have moved beyond your comfort zone. And as one of my psych professors put it, the eruption of emotion is the adult form of the same thing that happens when you watch your kid lose themselves in a crowd at the mall. You can see them, but they can't see you, and they suddenly realize that the person whose domain of competency in the world was indescribably larger than theirs is has disappeared, and the complexity that they considered you in control of now falls on them, and it overwhelms them. And so within like 3 minutes, they're sobbing uncontrollably. They went from a low-resolution environment to a high one, and they responded rationally to what they were experiencing, just like you are responding rationally to what you're experiencing. You just don't know how to articulate it yet because you didn't consciously know it was there. One of the funniest iterations of this happens every Sunday here at the Vineyard, and if you pay attention, you'll notice it too. I have two children, Jack, who is 3 and a half, and Aurora, who is 18 months. If you keep Jack and Aurora within eyesight of each other and you remove all of the adults, Aurora is completely fine. As soon as you remove Jack from eyesight, though, it doesn't matter how many adults are around. Aurora will completely lose it. Why? Because in her tiny world, Jack might as well be an adult compared to her. His worldly competency and familiarity frames her security. So long as Jack is fine, and if you know Jack, he was born fine with basically every environment, then Aurora is too. The point being, Aurora is being forced to move from low-resolution thinking to high-resolution thinking as soon as Jack is no longer there to allow her to experience her surroundings in low resolution. She doesn't entirely recognize that her surroundings were always that way, even though she wasn't consciously aware of them until after she is forced to by being out of her comfort zone, the result of which is an overwhelming flood of emotion and psychological distress. Make sense? Okay. So although I cannot read minds, as I said before, so too you may not be able to read your own mind. But we can both, when we stumble on a tear in your unconscious structure, investigate what we have both been surprised to find. Which is why when we meet up for coffee and are moving through theology and you begin to have a profound emotional response, we stop and we investigate further. I get hyper-precise with you on that particular subject matter. It isn't because I'm trying to torture you, it's because oftentimes the hole or tear or lesion, whatever you want to call it, to your unconscious is there due to something, probably trauma. And that means we need to dig into it in order to do spiritual surgery. Trauma treatments are pretty much the same on every level, physiologically, psychologically, and spiritually. Each tear to our person has different treatments and suturing protocols, and we won't be able to discover what that protocol is until we identify the trauma and what made it. And that's the beauty of all this painful investigation into your unconscious axiomatic structure. It's what it does to our attitudes going into the dialogue that is seeking to expose the tears. It requires of us a measure of softness of spirit that we might not otherwise have if we know that we're about to go into a conversation with someone who has rejected Christianity. The natural attitude check that occurs when you are dealing with someone in genuine pain versus an opponent in the field will become a preset for us. In effect, we'll move from an attitude of combat to an attitude of appropriate bedside manner. And this is why in the introduction to these things a few minutes ago, I said I wanted the Christians in the room to go ahead and begin this discussion with internal reflection. If you can jump into my brain for a minute to see what I'm thinking and doing to keep my orthopathy, orthopraxy, and orthodoxy in check and how I wield them in real time, then you'll be able to, at the very least, be able to understand what I'm getting at when I try to teach you to do the same. There's never a point in time when our defense of Christianity is a weapon. Apologetics is always in a framework of the gentle respect we have for the person in front of us, bolstered and aligned with a spine of the careful and intentional study of reflecting Christ. The reason we're firm and unyielding over scriptural truths and deep theological concepts is not because we want to flaunt our knowledge, but is because we cannot heal a theological ailment without first calling it what it is. And if you can jump into my brain in this way, then you can also keep me in check when my sin gets the best of me and I fail to be gentle delivering theological truth. Gentleness does not mean spinelessness, but nor does having a spine mean being justified in acting condescendingly. What better way is there for you to keep your friendly neighborhood apologist accountable? Right? How's that for full transparency? But even after all of what we've been talking about and considering so far tonight, there's even more here to unpack because what I've been trying to outline for you in all of this resolution and axiomatic structures talk is that what I'm showing you is literally the anatomy of persuasion, which is something Paul literally tells us we're supposed to be working at in apologetics. Are you picking up on that? How is it that you move a human being down a line of reasoning and actually have them embrace the conclusion you're trying to demonstrate to them personally? Why is it that we can have proofs and evidences and still those who encounter them are not immediately swayed by them? Why is it that you hear me say that proof is different than persuasion all the time? This is part of the reason why. and why this all matters, that you know about unconscious structures and be driven to a state of natural humility about our own specific unconscious structures, is because it's in this level of analysis that real neurophysiological transformation occurs. Listen to me on this. You are actually altering a person's brain for the better through dialoguing with them in this way. When all three of our apologetics frameworks is aligned in humble, Christ-centered focus of personal time and effort by you on behalf of your loved one through investigation of unconscious axioms at a high-resolution analysis, their neurological traumas actually move locations in their brain. I'm serious about this. This is not new information. Clinicians have known about this for years. I'm just applying the neurophysiology in a context that hasn't maybe been discussed like this before. It's why therapists tell you to journal and write about traumatic events that you can identify. Doing so forces you to begin processing a memory stored in your limbic system, a part of your brain that is deeply emotional and therefore handles raw function, toward the part of your brain responsible for cold rational assessment, your neocortex. And so that traumatic memory or tear in your unconscious moves locations in your psyche from raw pain to an articulated causal story by which you learn more about why you are you and why your reactions to certain stimuli are the way that they are, such that they no longer overwhelm you because you are practiced at assessing them at high resolution. And it's here that you heal the tear. It's here where you can actually know whether or not you're seeing the world accurately or through some unconscious filter that you didn't know was affecting you or driving your behavior or philosophical worldview. It's the difference between trying to suture a wound closed without anesthetic versus with it. It's the difference between going through labor without an epidural versus with an epidural. You're going to be able to process this better if we decrease the emotional pain. The remarkable part of this moment is because we as training apologists are quite literally healing a foundational axiom of your personal behavior through the process of Christ-centered dialogue. And with this knowledge, we're able to do the spiritual surgery needed in a way that the person who experienced the trauma can process without further psychological pain. The psychological environment with which the dialogue occurs matters. And it's up to us, as the apologist, to do the work of promoting that environment so that the person in front of us can see reality for what it really is while we keep the environment from becoming so overwhelming that they can no longer explore their trauma without further pain. Now, there's still debate on precisely how the move of memories in this scenario happens physiologically. We know that it happens. We just don't know how precisely it happens on a cellular level. But we do know that brain lesions, those are physical tears on the brain, can be healed. And if done effectively, the result is the release of the protein responsible for cell differentiation, cell shape and movement, maintenance of tissue and tissue survival, effectiveness of skeletal muscle and capillaries, as well as neuroregeneration, the only protein that we know of that can heal brain damage is this, laminin. That shape look familiar to you? This is the protein responsible for holding you together as a unit on a cellular level. All of the specific wrinkles of your brain adhere to each other because of this protein. Interestingly enough, this is the protein that forms the structural scaffolding in almost every tissue of an organism, meaning that we aren't talking about humans only here. We're talking that this protein holds all things together on a cellular level for all life on Earth, including plants. As your friendly neighborhood apologist, I am going to suggest that the fact that this looks like a cross to you is 100% not a coincidence. But wait, guess what? There is even more. If I take you into a space where your unconscious tears begin healing, your mental space becomes a new environment. And in new environments, we know that dormant genes will turn on inside of your nervous system, which will then code for new proteins. Those new proteins then in turn unlock and turn on new circuits in the brain. Those new circuits are what drives new behaviors. Those behaviors are what drives your habits, and those habits are what drives your character out of which you reap your destiny, as my childhood pastor would say. Which means the more that you allow me to expose you to apologetics in a Christ-centered environment with the intention of persuading you of healing real neurological trauma when we encounter it, what I am actually facilitating is a space where all of the potential you that is dormant in your genetic structure might become unlocked over time. Apologetics is not arguing people into the kingdom. Apologetics is the intentional self-sacrifice of time and cognitive discomfort, the practitioner operating in high-resolution cognitive environments on behalf of the person in front of us so that they have the security and freedom to move about their brain accurately, heal trauma, and observe themselves being transformed without becoming overwhelmed. Apologetics, in effect, is ultimately practicing self-sacrifice all the way down to a cellular level. And is that not, Christians in the room, after all, what we're supposed to be doing with our short time here on earth anyway? If we've been tasked by God to be placed in a location where some of our loved ones are undergoing deconstruction, they've sublimated because they didn't think their questions or concerns surrounding the church were welcome, and so they vented into a type of spiritual atheism because that appears to be the healthy outlet given what they're seeing others do around them, and now they're stuck there because they're not being given the type of environment by which to explore and expose their unconscious axiomatic structures, and the only thing they're exposed to is low-resolution thinking, then isn't it our duty, given all of this information, to be driven to our knees in prayer, self-reflection of our own role in all of this, and careful study of Christianity in order to invite them into that healing environment? Which means if you're a young Christian wondering what it is that your purpose in life is and what you really mean by that is that you're asking, what am I supposed to do as my job? The answer to your question is, I don't know for sure, but I definitely know what your purpose is between now and God answering that specific prayer. It's apologetics. Do it in every environment that you're placed in, and perhaps the reason you aren't getting a specific answer from God yet is not because he's ignoring you. It's because the potential inside of you has not yet been unlocked, and you wouldn't understand the answer to your question yet, even if he explained it to you. So do the next best thing in obedience to what he has told you about every Christian's purpose, because that isn't some pat dismissal of your concern. It is instead the very vehicle by which your concerns are addressed by God and the mode through which he has tasked all of us to get there. So is this not what we should all be doing with our time? I'd say so, but that's just my suggestion. Easy for me to say, I'm the apologist. Because some of these deconstructing folks in our midst, I think, haven't actually left Christianity. Some of these folks are just mad, and for good reason. I don't know how to process that trauma without causing more pain. And those are the folks I'm worried about the most, because without us pursuing them, they'll stay in that mental space until someone goes in and gets them out. That's a scenario of pure, unadulterated courage by us saying to them, look, I don't know what's going on, but you're worth 1,000 uncomfortable conversations. And I'm not letting Thanksgiving pass without telling you I love you and I want to have this conversation with you. We are Christians and we can do that for them because that's what Jesus did with us. And for the folks who left Christianity because they were never really Christians to begin with, they just had a superficial understanding of the faith and so got wrecked as soon as they did any real analysis of their beliefs. The great news there is that you have an individual that is willing to be real and really honest about what they believe, and now you have the opportunity to demonstrate the real Christ to them on a personal level, which of course is something you know well because you know him and they don't yet. So it's easy. Just make the introduction. And if you need help, there's lots out there, and not just by Christians. The best recent movement I've seen is with the atheists who themselves really wrestled with their own form of deconstruction, and through their study and exposure to apologetics, history, philosophy, and science, even on a clinical level, like I've been outlining tonight, have arrived at what they call a Christian atheism, which is the belief that of all the worldviews available and all of the iterations of human behavior known to man, that Christ and Christianity is the best form of human flourishing, even if they don't personally desire to have a relationship with Jesus. They can still, in their intellectual honesty, identify that Christianity is worth its salt because it's the only theological framework that defines, protects, and secures an objective moral framework and individual dignity for all humans everywhere, without exception. Christianity forbids at every level of analysis the removal of the sacredness and dignity of the human individual. And that is a unique feature of the religion and worthy of promoting, which means that I'd like to suggest to you that the future of our American culture is about to get incredibly interesting. We're about to watch the secular humanist society in which our nation is rapidly devolving into split like a denomination might split. Half of the atheists siding with the Christians on social issues, politics, and the like, because they agree that the Christian worldview is the most accurate out there, and the other half rejecting Christianity outright and opting for humanism. For example, I kid you not, I showed you Peter Boghossian at the first Rosh Hashanah community night we ever did. You'll recall that he was a very outspoken professor against Christianity and saw himself as someone responsible for making atheist evangelists because Christianity in particular was a virus to him. And now he's traveling with Roger Christie on a tour across the nation demonstrating that Christian apologists actually are the ones representing a coherent worldview against some of the larger social movements going on right now in our country, some of which we're going to talk about here shortly, in fact. See? Turns out even the angriest enemies of Christianity can come to terms with the depth and breadth of what we teach about humanity and individual dignity, even if they don't want a personal relationship with Jesus themselves. But it isn't just for intellectual reasons that there's a splitting of the atheist population. It's for the practical application of those reasons that these atheists are becoming increasingly troubled by what they're seeing coming down the pike by way of current and future arguments for the promotion of ideas that remove any notion of inherent human dignity. Arguments that appear to be being accepted on a low resolution level and not being discussed on the historically high resolution level they actually are. For example, increasing talks about transhumanism and elective cannibalism. Transhumanism is a movement, and I'm synthesizing a lot of information here, so know that, that seeks to upgrade the human body. So where your body has physical limitations, like your eyes can only see so far, transhumanism would seek to develop technology to increase your optical abilities beyond normal human thresholds, for example. Robotic and digital implants could, if developed successfully, turn you into a superhuman of sorts. But in general, a large focus of the transhumanist movement is an attempt to achieve a general utopia for human biological flourishing, perfect bodies, and immortality. Transhumanism has a ton of different facets, but for the purposes of this talk, I'm just going to focus on that last part, because what we're seeing happen in the initial stages of this movement is that, number one, they're finding that it's easier to manipulate human tissue to that end if it's still developing in the womb, and number two, that in the meantime, since we haven't yet eradicated death, perhaps the best thing to do with that tissue is to recycle it in order to decrease our carbon footprint on the earth. If we eat our dead, then our meat consumption will plummet, plummeting demand for alternative protein options, thus decreasing livestock numbers, thus removing the carbon gases that are produced on said farms, and voila, reduce carbon emissions. And why not? We already have a score of alternatives for recycling human bodies in the form of making human diamonds, human cement for use in rebuilding artificial reefs at sea, as well as the ultimate way of remembering a loved one, by turning their remains into tattoo ink so that you can carry them with you in your own body until you are ready to be recycled. The state of Washington, for instance, in May, did you see this? Became the first location on the planet to make human composting legal and to build a facility called Recompose, a center for composting bodies on beds of wood chip, hay, and alfalfa in 30 days or less so that the resulting nitrogen-rich soil might be used to garden elsewhere. And before you accuse me of balderdash, let me introduce you to behavioral scientist Magnus Söderlund of the Stockholm School of Economics, who, speaking at the recent Gastro Summit, said he believes eating human meat derived from dead bodies might be able to help save the human race if only a world society were to awaken to the idea. His panel talk entitled "Can You Imagine Eating Human Flesh?" argued that the conservative taboo against cannibalism would change over time if people could just try it out to see if they liked the taste, because living sustainably is the ultimate goal for the generation in which we live. So if they enjoy the flavor, then why wouldn't human flesh be the solution to food sustainability in the future? Right. And presumably, this mindset explains why Dutch television sensations Dennis Storm and Valerio Zeno echoed that sentiment by pointing out that cannibalism is not illegal in the Netherlands, consulting actual cannibals as well as butchers for the best cut of meat for their first try, and then televising their elective surgeries of a small portion of each other's buttocks and abdomen sautéed and consumed live on air. So why exactly is it that Christians and Christian atheists are teaming up by speaking out against this sort of behavior together? Because they realize what's happened when an entire society has been practicing devolving their Christian foundational heritage for decades is that we lose sight of the single most important foundational principle of human existence, that we were made in God's image. And that image extends to all human beings at all times and in all places. The image of God and how we articulate this theological point, I would like to suggest to you, will be the one issue we come back to over and over and over again in our immediate futures, in conversations about Christianity and what it means on a social level. And I want you to be able to articulate it accurately in both deconstructed contexts as well as in our own congregations. And I want you doing it on a high resolution level instead of a low one. Throughout history, there has been a concerted effort to try and isolate what precisely God meant by his image. And for the most part, discussions have surrounded explaining it in terms of certain characteristics. You'll hear people say things like consciousness, free will, communication, or reason, among others. The problem with this qualitative approach, however, is that theologians and philosophers have pointed out that it always comes up incomplete, meaning that every time there is an attempt to respond to a surrounding culture's breaking away from the image of God and the subsequent response of the church to isolate the characteristic that they are removing from an overall human dignity understanding of this concept means that we're never fully defining the image of God, but are rather only ever isolating particular problem instances. So where a culture might demand a formula by which to understand the image of God, so far the church can only point to specific characteristics of human dignity rather than a full picture. The interesting thing about this predicament being that none of this really needs to be dealt with this way. And other theologians and biblical scholars have pointed this out. The fact that we can isolate that human dignity is a fulcrum point in defining the image of God is because it is. It's just that there are two options for articulating dignity. Either you can go the quality route and point out characteristics of humanity that are being violated in a certain instance, like cannibalism, or you can go the overall route of showing that human dignity is not really a characteristic of humans, but is rather a status of humans, regardless of their characteristics. And it's here that I think we need to train ourselves when facing social issues that become so complex that they're overwhelming in the modern era. When we are flooded with high-resolution material that we've only ever encountered in a low-resolution framework, we need to remind ourselves that the image of God is a status, or if you would prefer, a title that has been conferred to a specific category of being called human. Because if you conceptualize the image of God in this manner, the rightness or wrongness of every social issue, every unnerving suggestion, every political maneuver or legal case pertaining to human dignity will become crystal clear to you. Well, at least I think for now. Why is it unacceptable to eat human flesh in any of its forms? Because that flesh is human, and the category of human has been conferred the title of the image of God and is therefore inherently of a higher level than food. And it doesn't matter how many different ways someone tries to swing this. They will never be able to get around the fact that what they are talking about is human and therefore possesses a dignity outside of specific characteristics. Let me give you another real-world example right now to illustrate what I'm talking about. Let's go back to that point number one regarding the focus of the transhumanist movement, a sort of altering of human beings in the womb in order to try to achieve perfection for a society, whatever that means. And don't miss this. That's a huge problem for transhumanism. Who is it precisely who gets to define perfection? Do you see why thinking about these things at high resolution is necessary? It really matters that we practice doing this. Right now, we have folks working hard to isolate certain genetic markers and alter them in children before they're born. Things like sex, eye color, hair color, you name it. One of the consequences of this work is that prenatal testing has become increasingly precise, which means that chromosomal abnormalities are identifiable at earlier and earlier stages. And these prenatal tests are becoming increasingly more available and cheaper as time moves on. Iceland, a nation that provides genetic counseling to expectant mothers, boasts a population almost entirely free of Down syndrome as a result. Almost all expectant mothers, when given the news that there is a chance their child will be born with Down syndrome, choose after counseling to extinguish their fetuses, which means that the Down syndrome population of Iceland has an elimination rate approaching 100%. Kari Stefansson, a geneticist whose company is responsible for studying and tracking almost the entire country's genomes, notes that we've basically eradicated Down syndrome people, but is concerned that heavy-handed genetic counseling is influencing decisions that are in no way medical. And he's right, considering that the deliberate, systematic attempt to erase a category of people, something Iceland has been successful at achieving through this method, is the definition of genocide. and as one such genetic counselor at the Landspítali National University Hospital in Reykjavik noted, that to see it that way, the way that I've just framed it, is too black and white, because we shouldn't look at what's happening as genocide. Instead, we should look at it as a thing that was ended. Interesting that she phrases it that way, considering that she also gives mothers who choose to exterminate their Down syndrome fetuses a prayer card, complete with the date the termination occurred, and a picture of two tiny footprints. What an odd way to respond to just a thing that ended. Denmark is close behind the 100% eradication mark at 98%. France is at 77% and recently passed a law preventing any commercials to air on television, asking mothers to reconsider their decisions after genetic counseling for World Down Syndrome Day. And the United States sits at an estimated 67% termination rate, but that number is from 2011, so I'm not sure where exactly we sit today, considering it appears that folks have started not tracking these things, which my pessimistic mind finds convenient. And as most of you are thinking, I suspect that given this modern case study and an overall discussion on elective abortion, that an abortion discussion in general is needed, since there are obvious implications to our thought experiment of seeing the image of God as a status rather than a characteristic in that topic as well. And you'd be right. There's a very good reason for why pro-choice advocacy tries very hard to remove any and all religious or theological arguments from the table before any debate ensues. And this is because they have no argument whatsoever if the image of God is a status to all humans. And this is an important point tonight for we Christians practicing apologetics on a high resolution level. If you follow my work, you know that how vocal I am, a pro-life advocate. I regularly train other advocates in all of the ways to respond to regular pro-choice objections as well, from biology to the history of the women's rights movements and everything in between. So for those of you who are bristling right now, thinking that you came to a theological discussion and are about to get an earful on scientific arguments against abortion, don't worry. That's not what I'm about to do. And that's not what's about to happen. We can do that later. For now, this is the critical point I want to focus on, and is really only for the Christians in the audience, as they are the only ones expected to be consistent in Christian theology. And because, remember, tonight is a night of self-reflection and plank pulling to the edification of our minds. If the image of God is a status conferred to all humans, regardless of characteristic, then the human in the womb ought not to be exterminated. Period. There's no way around this theologically. And this means that as far as future argumentation is concerned on this topic, as this situation develops, for those of us who try to keep only to non-Christian arguments against abortion, there will come a day where all of those arguments will fail to be persuasive, and the only thing standing between the curette, suction probe, and the baby is our speaking the truth in love via the Word of God. And we need to be prepared for that. It doesn't matter how small, it doesn't matter what their chromosomal status is, it doesn't matter how many of them there are, it doesn't matter their level of development, state of consciousness, desirability, it doesn't matter whether or not you can detect brain activity, or the method by which they arrived in the womb. It doesn't matter what your personal definition of personhood is. Any entity has the title imager of God simply because they're human. A status that cannot be removed except by God, and are therefore imbued with the status of sacred and dignified. And just with any other human being, the deliberate attempt to remove a human from the earth by sacrificing them on behalf of ourselves is a clear inversion of the gospel. We are to sacrifice ourselves on behalf of others, not the other way around. And we're called to use our lives here on earth to reflect that fact and persuade those around us to do the same. Which means, loved ones, there is no rationally coherent justification for men and women who call themselves Christians to also promote elective abortion for any reason. Even in the case of life of the mother, like an ectopic pregnancy, what we are dealing with there are two humans. One human is a hospice patient because we haven't advanced far enough in medical technology to move implantation sites without ending the baby's life. And the other is not yet a hospice patient, but will become one once the pregnancy advances far enough to burst the fallopian tube if no one intervenes. Which is why we grieve the loss of the one who cannot yet be saved and comfort the one who can be saved. It is not because the mother is intrinsically more valuable or more human than the baby. and the painful reality that we have not advanced our technology far enough to be able to transport the baby into an artificial womb in order to save them does not remove the fact that what we are dealing with in genuine life of the mother cases is two human beings who are imagers of a holy and infinite God, to whom both will go to enjoy eternity in his presence if they're believers. And let me say this quickly by way of side note. For this reason also, Christians must abandon the inexcusably inconsistent tradition of waiting to announce pregnancies until the viability date. Viability does not determine the reality of the humanness of the pregnancy. Miscarriages are an instance of deep grief of which you should not go through alone. I know you might think that you're helping a woman keep grief at bay by encouraging this, but let me be the first to tell you that no such thing exists. And everyone who's gone through a miscarriage will attest to that. And that is the Christian framework that provides the consistent relief and celebration of the fact that you will see your child again, whether they were 7 weeks old or 30. It doesn't matter. If you're pregnant and a Christian or non-Christian alike, don't hide, because it's a celebration. And you should have folks alongside you no matter what happens. You should never feel guilted into silence about announcing your joy until the 12-week mark, ever. The stick turning blue is a confirmation of a reality that's already 4 weeks old. We have a human being capable of great potential, and we can't wait to see what they do with it. It's time to be loud in joy and not quiet for fear of some silly rule some well-meaning person in the past invented to try and help. As Christians, let's let that particular tradition die, right? Let's do that. And we can, of course, take this whole theme further down to its necessary conclusion on the other end of the age spectrum in similar high-resolution format. If a human has been given the status of an imager of God, you also cannot elect to exterminate someone elderly, because the characteristics of deteriorated mental faculties, reliance upon medical aid to function, or whatever definition of quality of life is convenient at the moment, does not remove an individual's imager of God status either. So that eliminates euthanasia. And what is more is that this applies to the self-election to remove our own life. If we have the status of imager of God, it doesn't matter in the slightest that the medically assisted suicide movement is gaining traction. Switzerland, for example, has so legalized this framework that they are now experiencing a phenomenon called suicide tourism, where anyone wishing to end their life in a physician-assisted environment can travel to their country to do so. We do not have the right to remove an imager of God from the planet, even if we ourselves are the human being removed. Which means that this movement calling itself Death with Dignity is particularly dark from a theological perspective, given that they have completely inverted the meaning of dignity in order to convince people to embrace it. And physicians engaging in this activity, as well as the euthanizing of the elderly, invert their vows to protect the sanctity of life by redefining the Hippocratic Oath to include the current society's definition of life and exclude the original intention of their vow to protect the sanctity of life, period. Not just the lives that they personally think are worth living. All right, here's your verbal warning. As promised, the next slides are a series of photographs of genocide. And so through all of this, you should be picking up on a theme. And it is this theme that those atheists aligning themselves with the Christian framework have picked up on too. In the cases we've just discussed, we have thought experiments that essentially boils down to a very old and very well-documented human phenomena. It's literally present in every civilization in the history of mankind. Here is your high-resolution word: infrahumanism. Or more simply, an overall treatment of one's in-group as more human somehow than an out-group. Remember this word, you will be using it. It's the movement of the definition of what it means to be human, to be whatever is convenient at the time for whoever is in power. It's the sacrificing of the weak on behalf of the strong. The reason that this is a troubling development is that for all intents and purposes, if we adopt a secular humanist framework, which it looks like we're going to do here fairly rapidly as a nation, there is absolutely nothing wrong with casting the world into categories of in-groups and out-groups. Since secular humanism denies objective moral categories and favors personal or societal preference as the vehicle by which morality is judged, then infrahumanism is given the green light to flourish, because the fulcrum point for assessing the case studies that I have just given you will only ever be personal or societal preference. Infrahumanism does not require secular humanism in particular as a foundation for its practice. In fact, it can be found in many, many alternative religions to Christianity as well. It just so happens that our culture, as well as the rest of the West, has begun favoring secular humanism in particular, and so we'll be seeing the non-overtly religious iteration of infrahumanism in our future. So long as a society says, yeah, we'll go ahead and look the other way on X, Y, or Z issue, the human beings who find themselves in the out-group will be exterminated by those in the in-group. Don't believe me? Let me show you just a few less modern examples. And that's the end of the genocide slides if you want to look up. We will begin with the great death pit of Ur, dating to 4,600 years ago, in the very same city out of which Abraham was tasked by God to leave in Genesis. The sacrifice of outgroup individuals, individuals of non-noble or non-royal birth, to honor a recently deceased royal, was the practice of this particular society. Human sacrifice was done over a period of days. Initially, the deceased royal's body was preserved through a smoking procedure and application of mercury to maintain it through the festivities. Once complete, live attendants to the deceased were sealed into the burial chamber with bricks. It appears the attendants were allowed poisons to consume, given that they're buried with intact headdresses and cups nearby. However, after this ritual is complete, human sacrifices begin in separate chambers or sunken courts called death pits, where up to anywhere between 6 to 80 people were walled in to slowly die of asphyxiation or blunt force trauma, as guards were also walled in with weapons to keep the occupants from attempting to break out. It's believed the grandeur of the spectacle was performed in order to feature the power of the king, who made his home in the great ziggurat, thusly demonstrating to those watching that he held the power of life and death in his hand as their god. Which means, if we are keeping in mind our hermeneutic circle, which I know you know well by now, as we exegete passages of scripture, and if this is Abraham's context of understanding how gods work, then the whole sacrifice of Isaac episode is critical for Yahweh to communicate to Abraham in a way that is uncoerced, that he is both truly God and very different from the Ur royals claiming to be divine that Abraham has only ever known. When communicating with a god, human sacrifice would have been expected by Abraham, yet when it came to the task, Yahweh instead provides a ram in the thicket to preserve the potential human sacrifice's life. A reversal of the societal and cultural norm when interacting with the divine of the day. Yahweh communicates that he, although truly God, is not a god like Abraham had previously known. And don't miss this. The fact that the sacrifice that was provided in lieu of the human one was specifically a ram caught in a thicket would have been deeply impactful, given that we have evidence that Ur royalty was adorned with silver and gold miniatures of animals caught in thickets, which means that Abraham would have come from a context where humans were sacrificed to honor graven images of rams caught in thickets, only to find that when dealing with Yahweh, rams caught in thickets are sacrificed to preserve human life. The point being that in this cultural context, the out-group of non-royals was sacrificed on behalf of the in-group royalty. And of course, this is shared amongst many other ancient cultures where a person's class status determined their sacrificial potential. The lowest class, of course, being non-royal children. In fact, every pre-Columbian culture to date has been found to have practiced child sacrifice so extensively that even up until the 1400s, the surviving forms of these civilizations were doing this at a rate that modern archaeologists cannot keep up with. There are currently 3 active dig sites in Peru, out of which have come more than 600 bodies, and of which the chief archaeologist, Farron Castillo, reports, "It's uncontrollable, this thing with the children. Wherever you dig, there's another one." But most famously, across the pond in the area of Phoenicia and Carthage, is by far the most extensively documented practice of child sacrifice. Canaanite child sacrifice practices are so well attested historically that our documentation for it spans a millennia. What would happen is that the people would make deals with whichever avenging god they wished to commune with, Baal, Moloch, Kronos, doesn't matter because the result would be the same. Instead of vowing to the god on their own lives, they would vow to one of these gods on the lives of their children, so that if they received the thing that they had asked for, they would then take their child to be slaughtered as a compensation for the blessing. And if they didn't have any children to do this with, they could go to the market where impoverished children were sold as stand-ins to fulfill these vows. I'm going to let Cleitarchus, one of Alexander the Great's historians, who was present to witness these things firsthand, describe to you what happens next. A bronze Kronos, having been erected by them, stretched out upturned hands over a bronze oven to burn the child. The flame of the burning child reached its body until, the limbs having shriveled up and the smiling mouth appearing to be almost laughing, it would slip into the oven. Therefore, the grin is called sardonic laughter, since they die laughing. I can keep going, but I think you get it. The point is that the penultimate and initial form of infrahumanism is a culture, in a culture, is to make the most vulnerable humans, the children, the outgroup by which they are exterminated in the service of the strong, or the adults in power, the in-group. And the troubling thing is, for those who track these things through cultures, this initial stage is the precursor to all other forms of infrahumanism. When whoever is drawing the circle around what constitutes humanity excludes some members of the human family by redefining the status of imager of God to include themselves and to exclude whoever is, in their view, worthy of exterminating on behalf of the strong. Which means once a society begins sacrificing their children on behalf of themselves, the next caste of vulnerables gets marked for death, then the next, and the next. And you have functioning brains and working eyes. You can watch this quite clearly happening in the talking points of our society's politicians and clinicians. In less than one generation, after a very famous court case made it legal to end the lives of the unborn for any reason through the entire 9 months of pregnancy nationwide, we have gone from a societal mantra of safe, legal, and rare, to safe, legal, accessible, and affordable, to my body, my choice, to the mantra screamed in my face by local students at UT protesting pro-life evangelism, yeetus the fetus. It is self-evident that the argument for abortion changes annually and not toward the initial promise of rarity. The lowest abortion rate ever recorded by Planned Parenthood's Guttmacher Institute for the U.S. was in the year 2017. The rate was 2,363 abortions per day. If you assume no one in these abortion facilities took a lunch, that would be 236 abortions per hour or 4 abortions per second. And that's the lowest rate. And so with such a rapid devolution of societal acceptance of such things and the consequent use of the exact same justifications for alternative forms of infrahumanism, like in the cases of terminating the elderly, arguments like their quality of life won't be worth living, the financial burden is too severe, the caregivers didn't ask to be put in this situation, and the psychological burden will be too great for them, etc., has so unnerved certain atheists and agnostics that they have begun to point at the fact that the only religion in the world where the strong are called to sacrifice themselves on behalf of the most vulnerable, even to the point of including one's enemies in the human family, is Christianity. Perhaps the Christian worldview that does not allow for infrahumanism is the one keeping all the death at bay. We have arrived at quite a place when even the world's most vocal critics are concerned that perhaps getting rid of Christianity is not a good idea if what Christianity does is keep worse things at bay. But Anna, isn't there that one Bible account in the Old Testament where God himself induces an abortion as punishment for a woman who is suspected of being guilty of adultery? Is not that an instance of God ordaining abortion, at least under some circumstances? Yeah, you'd be referencing the ordeal of bitter waters in Numbers chapter 5, a fitting final set of weird Bible verses brought up by deconstructing Christians and even some pro-choice advocates. So I'll spend some time outlining this, and then we'll end our semester in deconstruction and open up for some Q&A. Let me give you the background context in case you've never read it. This passage is an instrumental instructional description of what to do in the case of a husband who suspects his wife has committed adultery, but he has no proof. If such a thing occurs, the husband is to bring his wife before the high priest in the tabernacle. She is to affirm an oath that she will accept whatever Yahweh's judgment is of her, since he and she are the only two parties who know for certain the truth. And then she is to drink some water with dust from the tabernacle floor mixed with bits of parchment containing verses surrounding the topic of adultery. If the woman is innocent, nothing will happen and she is free to go. But if she is guilty, she will experience bitter pain in her abdomen as it swells, followed by her thigh falling, and that will be the sign that Yahweh has found her guilty of the accusation and exacted the penalty for her behavior. No matter what happens in this divine trial, once the verdict is rendered, the woman goes free. The ordeal of bitter water is a protective clause for women who are living in an environment of being suspected of adultery. This predicament would have been grievously difficult for women in these states, as no matter whether they're guilty or innocent of the suspicion, every facet of their life would have been affected, from a peaceful living with one spouse all the way to doing business amongst the camp. Unresolved suspicions of all types left to fester inside marriages and communities can plummet a household into permanent chaos. Suspected adultery being an obvious example of how this might come to be. If this was occurring within the tabernacle framework, everyone would be witnessing this dynamic, and the woman's reputation would be tarnished beyond repair. Moreover, the husband could simply accuse his spouse, divorce her, the result of which would be destitution and ruin for the woman, all on the basis of a no-way-out scenario, whether she was actually guilty or not. And so this law is present for a multitude of reasons, the most obvious being to reestablish marital harmony when irreparable damage has threatened a divorce, and to restore any reputational damage that this dynamic has caused the accused party in the greater community framework. But even more importantly, and this is for anyone who's ever experienced domestic violence at the hands of raw emotional brutality, this law could be appealed to by the woman or the greater community in order to expose irrational jealousy to the point of physical danger, which is what the Hebrew word there rendered jealousy includes. And this is significant here. The only way to accuse someone of adultery in front of a human court in the tabernacle framework is upon the testimony of two witnesses minimum. Not witnesses to the actual event of adultery, but rather two minimum who are willing to stake their lives on their testimony. As the penalty for witnessing falsely is that the verdict that would have been rendered on the original person accused now falls on the witnesses who lied. Investigations were significant back then too, just like today. Trials aren't some quick thing in a tabernacle framework. And in the case of adultery, that punishment is stoning. On top of this, the witnesses, if the person accused is found guilty, are required to be the first people to cast stones upon the guilty before the rest of the community, which means not only must they be willing to take the penalty upon themselves if they're being flagrant with their testimony, but they must also be the initial executioners after the verdict is rendered. The point being, there's a very specific protocol in order for a human court to have jurisdiction over a case. And in the case of an unraveling marriage and reputation due to suspicion, there are no witnesses, and therefore the situation is outside of human jurisdiction. So how does an innocent woman get exonerated? Going through this trial, overseen not by humans, but rather by Yahweh, who is already well aware of her guilt or innocence, is the only way. And that's the beauty of the design. Absolutely nothing happens to the woman if she's innocent. The man is made to make a sacrifice to cover his heavy-handedness in front of the people, and now if he has been violent to her in a domestic context, the poor reputation now flips to the man and is permanent. There is no equivocal reputation builder type law for men who do this to their wives, which means domestic abusers are exposed immediately as what they are when this law is enacted. And if she is guilty of adultery, Yahweh's judgment upon her is permanent, meaning that the husband cannot bring further accusations upon her in order for her to go through a second trial resulting in stoning or divorce. So even though she is actually guilty, she is spared the penalty of her guilt since Yahweh has already judged her, and mercifully so. Okay, Anna, so what is with the whole bitter pain, belly swelling, and whatever thigh falling means? There's actually very little debate about this, interestingly enough, to answer that question. The only real debate is what's happening on a physiologically detailed level. The term that's rendered thigh falling for the woman is the exact same as it was for when it applied to men. It's that you are no longer able to bear children. It's a euphemism. As far as the bitter pain and belly swelling, there are arguments for everything from what is called experiencing a supernatural and accelerated false pregnancy, also called a hysterical pregnancy, all the way to what happens when your uterus prolapses. Any number of those combinations could be what they're referencing. We don't know. But the point of the passage is to say that if she is guilty, the result will be she will not be able to conceive past that point, and that this is Yahweh's judgment upon her choosing to behave this way. Because remember, this judgment only occurs if the woman willingly and willfully engaged in adultery. She is innocent if she was raped or coerced. Yeah, but Anna, my 2011 NIV says that she'll miscarry. Doesn't that mean that if she is pregnant from the interaction, that part of Yahweh's judgment upon her is to supernaturally abort the baby? Yeah, about that. This has to be one of the most frustrating parts about being an apologist, is when things like this happen by modern scholarship. The new NIV is one of only 2 out of 39 available in English Bible translations to opt for that word. And it was a change from the previous 1984 edition. When contacted, Bruce Waltke, one of the members of the translation committee for the NIV, explained that the usage of the term miscarry was meant to explain a false pregnancy, that hysterical pregnancy I was talking about. Psychological realities like false pregnancy would have been present back then, too, and if the woman was under duress and guilty of adultery, her mind would trouble her, and her body would act like it was pregnant. If she was innocent, her mind wouldn't trouble her. There's no actual baby involved for obvious reasons, and on top of that, there are no abortificants involved in the slurry that she's made to drink. When pressed that abortion advocates were using this translation to justify abortion, his response was, "A person who wants to believe that is going to believe it. It's very difficult for me to get that out of this passage, because obviously she becomes swollen not due to sexuality, but due to the drinking of the water. Maybe miscarry wasn't the best translation, but I think it carries the intention of the passage. There will be no baby." When pressed further on how this passage was being used as proof text for abortion, he replied, "Using this passage to justify abortion shocks me." So too with other translations that use miscarry, the other one. It's the Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament. Editor Mervyn Richardson explains that the introduction of miscarriage he stands by, but admits that perhaps they should have left it the way it literally reads, since the true term, miscarriage, is a speculation. Vern Poythress of the English Standard Version Oversight Committee has this to say to the whole debacle. "It's not as if the editors of the NIV are trying to be manipulative. They honestly think that this is a euphemism, but that translation is purely postulation. Other biblical passages that describe a miscarriage use more direct expressions to make the meaning obvious. The particular Hebrew phrase that appears here doesn't appear anywhere else in the Bible, leaving little guidance for interpretation. Either way, it's not really parallel to someone using modern abortificants. The water's effect is supernatural, meaning non-clinical, because it varies depending on whether the woman is guilty or not, not on whether she is pregnant. Another factor is the special role that God has here, that he himself is doing a supernatural judgment that doesn't authorize human beings in general to bring a judgment on other people. What Christians could say is, we believe in protecting the life of the unborn child, but God has the right to take life whenever he wants, and of course he does." And Poythress is right, as well as Wayne Grudem, who is general editor of the ASV and was asked the same question. There are 2 Hebrew words for miscarriage, and neither of them are used here, and what the NIV crew opted for was dubious, since they did not leave open the reality that there are other options available to understand this passage. The conclusion being, no, this passage cannot be used to justify abortion in the modern clinical sense in any way, shape, or form, even by the testimony of the very minority of translators who decided to use the term miscarry instead of the literal phrase, "thigh will fall." Okay? Can't be used. All right. That's it. Let's open up for some Q&A. The last round of the semester. So this is when you hit me with all those crazy questions you've been withholding. Go for it.
Is this on? Oh, it is.
Hi, Isaiah.
Hi, Anna. So earlier you were talking about assisted suicide. Uh-huh. Where do you draw the line between, say, assisted suicide and, I don't know, I guess an example would be something like late stage leukemia and refusing treatment?
And refusing treatment?
Yes.
Yeah, so medical treatment. So the question was, if you couldn't hear it, what's the line between assisted suicide and refusing treatment when you're already dying of something? So already dying of something that cannot be cured, and our treatments, all the treatments are doing is either keeping the person, prolonging the person's life, for whatever reason due to comfort, I'd have to take it on a case-by-case basis. There's a difference between someone who's already dying and somebody who's electing to die because they no longer wish to live but would live if they were left alone without taking the pill. So there's a difference there. There's also a difference between the amount of pain and the level of, like, how much of our clinical material is keeping them alive. So there's a difference between, like, being on a ventilator versus not, versus hospice care, which is effectively keeping somebody comfortable until they expire naturally. All of those things I would have to take into account. So to answer your question, it's not a cop-out. I would have to take it on a case-by-case basis because I don't have a formula, and I'm not sure a formula is appropriate for me to try to make up from the stage right now. I would probably mess it up. That being said, though, are they remaining in a dignified human form, dignified biblically, all the way through? Or is something happening where there's somebody else involved saying, I don't really want to deal with this anymore. Go ahead and take off. You see what I mean? Like, there's a difference, and intention matters. So the answer to your question is, I don't know. I don't know where the line is. But I know where the intention is. And if we take it on a case-by-case basis, I bet we would be able to figure that out pretty quickly. We'll see. I hope you don't feel like that was a cop-out. Okay. Hey.
This is playing on the rest of that.
Okay.
I think it's just like everything else in the scripture. Mm-hmm. It is the intent of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the intent of the heart is, like you say, you know, I just don't want to deal with this anymore or whatever, mm-hmm. is different than, you know, this is more than I can handle. This is more than I can bear. This is,
yeah.
That's different than, like, I'm out of here.
Right. Well, and one of the things, too, that to keep in mind is they're usually, like, and when you're talking to a physician, and I'm just saying, it's talking in general, on, like, end-of-life care, palliative care, mm-hmm. right? It's already understood you are going to die from this thing. Do you want us to let it take its natural cause, like, natural course mm-hmm. and keep you comfortable? Or do you want to keep fighting to prolong? And the pain that's involved in the keep fighting may not be worth it, but that's not the point. The natural expiration of the person when God's going to take them home is going to happen anyway.
Exactly.
So it does, yeah. It really does matter that we take this on a case-by-case yeah. basis.
My dad fought 18 years ago. My dad passed, and he fought for 2 years fighting cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took the long route,
mm-hmm.
you know, and fought it out for 2 years. And there was a lot of time in that, you know, memories and things that were made in those 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like you say, I believe that if he had said, well, I'm just not going back to the doctor, whenever his time was going to expire was going to be
mm-hmm.
be it.
Mm-hmm. My grandmother opted. She was dealing with cancer. She went through chemotherapy. She's very elderly, a believer. And she was like, it was so painful for her to go through the chemotherapy. She was so miserable, she could barely talk about it. She was like, I just want to go when the Lord's ready to take me. That's different than, yeah, I'm ready to be done. I just want to check out, hand me the pill. Totally different. Yeah, and as technology advances and as medicine advances, these things will change too, which is why understanding the parameters with which guide all of our decisions, all these things rapidly change all the time, and we're overwhelmed is so critical. And yeah, the hard part about Christianity is that we always want to have this formula in these really difficult situations, when the truth is sometimes where is the line that God's looking for, and the line is in your own heart, which is why self-reflection is so important, and submitting to God's word is so important. Della.
Hi. So I forget, I wish I wrote it down when the question popped in my head, but it has to do with, I saw a fourth trimester abortion,
yes.
I think, and
yep.
I was like, there's only three trimesters. That's
good.
Why it's called a trimester.
Good.
And so does that brings up my question of, is it age of consciousness? Like when can a child register Christ, I guess? I can't find the words to phrase it
you kind of get what I'm trying to
say? Scripture says that John the Baptist rejoiced in utero when Jesus came in the room, still in utero, documented. When does consciousness occur? Huge question. The answer is we don't know, and neither does science.
Fun.
Yeah. So the fourth trimester abortion thing I put up there is because as we're moving down the spectrum, it matters that we keep tabs on this stuff because the arguments go, right? It's all based on the baby and the trauma that it puts on the mother, and you need to be able to abort the baby because of the mother's traumas. Well, those traumas exceed well into the baby's life after the baby's born. So why shouldn't you be able to end the baby's life for the first 3 months? And in reality, what's happening right now, too, there are protective cases for babies who are botched abortions. So the baby's born alive. What do you do? Are you required to apply emergency medicine to this person who is now alive and outside of the womb, which is the normal framework? And the laws state that you are not. You can leave them on the table to die. And that's what they do. That's what I'm talking about, fourth stage abortion. We are already moving into, they're still not human even after they've been removed from the womb.
That is terrible.
We're already there.
Yeah.
Safe and Rare was 1992. It is 2021. I'm sorry? The fourth stage abortion, I have to look at a couple of them. New York for sure. Yeah. I think California is another one.
Yeah.
No surprises there. Probably New Jersey. I'd have to double check. I don't have a map for that, but it'd be easy to find. Hi, Dad. This is my dad.
Hi,
Anna's
dad.
Hi.
You didn't watch the Chiefs game.
No, I didn't. I had it on my phone, but I shut it off. So, augmented human bodies with artificial things. We already have knee replacements, hip replacements, spinal fusions, artificial lenses for people with cataracts. How do we decide when we draw that line and what that line is as bionics accelerates and proceeds with augmentation of the human body?
I don't know. We're discussing this the next semester with my engineering crew because they're literally doing stuff. But here's where I think it probably is, if I could put my finger on it. There's a difference between fixing something that's broken and cutting off healthy tissue because you think you can do better than God.
Very good. Okay.
I'd say that I can't quite isolate where the line is, but I'm pretty sure it's somewhere between those two points. Okay. Thank you. I'm trying. Trying, guys. Do this for you. It's a lot of thinking for this one. Could you tell? Yeah. Hey, Brian.
Those are some really good questions. This concept of infrahumanism is interesting to think about. So two questions. One is not talking about Christian worldview, talking about Christian people. Do you have any thoughts on to what degree maybe Christians are guilty of infrahumanism? And if so, why is that appealing or why is that tempting for people who call themselves Christians to engage in?
Yeah.
And how do you... What are some examples, if you can think of it?
Yeah. I suspect infrahumanism is a manifestation of the sinful nature of man at a base level. Right, because we see this all the time. And it's why God talks ad infinitum about not behaving that way. So it makes total sense to me that we would see this in a Christian context. Like, in my mind, goes straight to denominational preferences and infighting on secondary and tertiary issues that we really, I mean, the world is going to pieces, but we can't handle discussing free will and God's sovereignty without tearing each other's eyeballs out. Like, that's not right. Or looking down our noses at other denominations that we don't agree with. I could see that being a form of infrahumanism. Obviously, it's not genocidal, but it's still the same thing. You have an in-group and an out-group. And I think it happens because we like the thought of having it together And we like to compare ourselves to other humans and think to ourselves that we're better than they are because it makes us feel comfortable in our skin, that we've got it together enough that we can move on in a life that we don't have together, that is marked by significant sorrow and tragedy. And it's painful. And that's not fun, and you don't want to think about it. So if you can point at somebody else that's hopefully experiencing the world in a more tragic sense than you are, then you can sit there and go, well, at least I'm not that person, which apparently is something Jesus also wanted to focus on, since he says directly not to do that, because that's what the Pharisees do as well. So it's sin, I think. I don't think I'm reaching to say that that's what it is. I hope that's a satisfactory answer. Cuba.
Hey. I was thinking, how should this picture you painted about the high resolution, low resolution thinking, how should that affect the way we approach evangelizing and reaching to new people? Should we try to keep them in their low resolution thinking as long as possible and only go to the high resolution thinking when we have to?
Yeah.
Or should we try to build the high resolution thinking and then go back to the low resolution?
Yeah. Okay. So that's theory of evangelism, which is a class that you can take in many seminaries, and that's actually a massive debate between folks who are doing this, because some folks think, and rightly so, the gospel is not, it's not a difficult message. So presenting it in a way that is not hyper-difficult or too heady or you're going to lose the person is exceptionally valuable. At the same time, we live in a situation in a society that is so hungry for high-resolution thinking. It's almost like as soon as you start talking about this stuff, people are like, what? Remember cannibalism? You were there for the first cannibalism. The talk I gave on campus on cannibalism that you guys got kind of got a little piece of here was one of the highest attended meetings we've ever had, and I've had to repeat it 3 times, and it's the only topic I've had to repeat on that level, because people were so interested on how to answer this question because they didn't know how to answer it themselves. So the high resolution, the hunger for that, I think is there as well. So what do we do in an evangelism sense? This is Anna talking. This is just my own personal view. You pray actively as you go out, and the person who comes to you, whatever the Holy Spirit tells you to do, you run with that. That being said, you shouldn't be afraid of doing any of the different ones, because it's whatever the person needs in front of you. So try to stay away from, and this is why I train you guys with this, try to stay away from formulas, right? And if you're really nervous and you really need those tracked formulas where you say you're on a script and it's A, B, C, I understand, but try to get away from that. Have a conversation. Be real. Do we really know Jesus? Let's introduce him. But that's just my 2 cents. And we'll practice. Okay, that's actually pretty good time. We're 4 minutes away from our normal cutoff. Yes, thank you very much. Very great privilege to be able to talk to you and for you to spend Sunday nights with me. The next Ratio Christi will be in May, so it's a while from now, but it'll be in May. I don't know what the topic is going to be. And just by way of correction, because I just remembered, I said that we do astral projection on campus last talk, if you were here for that, because my brain was going faster than my mouth. We do not astral project at Ratio Christi on campus. I teach on the topic of astral projection at Ratio Christi on campus, just by way of clarification. All right, be safe. Merry Christmas. Happy Thanksgiving. I'll be here if you want me to answer more questions, okay?